which is a really interesting idea of, like, don't become the thing that they said you were.
Yeah.
Like, they said you did a murder and a betrayal. Don't go out of here and do a murder betrayal. And I was like, oh, that's going to be really interesting to watch him thread that needle. And then at the very end, he's like, I would do just one murder.
Well, Lillian, this unfortunately is not that kind of story. This is the kind of edgy, dramatic story where the innocent guy says, you want me to be the monster? Fine, I'll be the monster. And then he becomes a cool dude.
Which I should have known, because Piper loves somebody who's a little bit a monster.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Just a little bit of a monster.
Hello, Lillian, and hello, listeners. We are finally back to not talking about Jane Eyre on our Jane Eyre podcast. Whew, thank God.
Thank God.
Oh my gosh. How you feeling, Lil?
I'm feeling quite ill, Piper. Mm-hmm. I apparently am my body is no longer physically able to do a whirlwind trip like we did. So it is rejecting it hard.
See, I don't think I was able to do that trip either. And I don't think I ever again want to do a trip that's less than 42 hours with a turnaround. So we did it once. We could check it off our list. Never again.
Our last night flying out, we had 3 hours of sleep. We got back to the hotel at like just shy of, we got back at like midnight and we had to leave to get to the airport at 3:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. It felt to me, I'm not someone who likes naps. So if I ever fall asleep during the day and then I wake up and like the sun's still up or like suddenly it's nighttime, I'm like, what's happening? I'm just dazed and confused. And that was me in that hotel room. So, but we made
it back.
You
missed Piper making a little troll face. It was very good.
I just picture it. Just picture a look of sheer confusion.
If we're not talking about Jane Eyre today, Piper, what are we talking about?
So we put up a poll, as we usually do, for our palate cleansers. And because it was my birthday on Tuesday, I got to choose all the options. And the one that won is probably in my top 10 favorite movies of all time. It's The Count of Monte Cristo.
Nice.
So that is what we are talking about here today. And I remember, Lillian, you had said at some point, whether it was on air or off air, that you felt you had never seen this movie before.
Can confirm. Okay. Can confirm, have never seen this movie before. Did not know the plot. Every twist got me.
Oh boy. Oh my God. A fun theory to insert into this is because I think you at least have been present in the room when it's on. Because I swear to God, there was a sleepover in high school or middle school where we put this on. I think you were conked out. Because remember Maya and I talking through this movie. So
that is a classic us in like middle school, high school story is that we would have sleepovers in Piper's basement and we would put on a movie and I would fall asleep almost immediately. And then they'd watch like four more movies while I just slept.
Yes. And like maybe at like 2 a.m. you'd kind of like roll over and be like, guys, it's like really late. Can you like be quiet? And we're like, no, we're dying.
Classic.
So thank you for putting up with all of that.
Well, thank you for putting up with me being 7 years old at 16.
No worries. Okay, so I think we're going to start with a good old recap. Lillian did not expect that she'd have to do, so
I forgot. I didn't track it down, so I didn't take any notes for this recap, and this is going to be Lillian's remembrance of a one-time watch, and I'm going to go with high-level plot points.
Very good. This is a complicated story, so yes, top level is good.
Yes.
I'm ready to time you whenever you're ready to start.
Okay, here we go. Well, we start with two very best friends, and you get kind of weird vibes from one of them, and then the other one is far too sweet for this world, and his name is Edmund, and far too sweet for this world boy just trusts people, and so he does technically a crime, and when they get back to the where they're from in France, it turns out that far too sweet for this world boy, Edmund, has a lady love, and best friend also has a thing for this lady love. And so best friend is like, hey, I'm just going to quick betray you so that I can fuck your girlfriend, which is not great. And sweet boy ends up through a series of blunders and also kind of technically a crime by accident, oopsie, being sent to prison on the saddest, most upsetting island of all time. We proceed to watch this man be tortured for a decade and a half with essentially Dumbledore is also there. And he learns all sorts of stuff and digs a hole and then escapes because he pretends to be a dead body. And then he makes a new very best friend who we'll talk about a lot, working with smugglers. And he finds secret buried treasure and becomes the Count of Monte Cristo. Mm-hmm. And he exacts his plan for revenge. And his lady love has married his betrayal best friend. Oh, my God. Why would she do that? And it turns out that the reason why she did that was because she had been pregnant with this human child. And we learned this through a series of shenanigans around revenge. And then he decides not to kill his former best friend betrayer, even though he could. And then he immediately re-decides to do it instead again. And happy ending, because he let go of his anger after doing a murder and killing everyone and like destroying everyone's life whoever betrayed him. And he gets his wife and 15-year-old son.
2 minutes, 5 seconds.
It was a bad recap.
Lillian, I think my favorite thing is every time that you're like, I'm going to just hit the high level stuff. But then you're like, oops, but then this thing happens.
Like, I just like, don't know how to do. I think what we're learning on this podcast, if we were going to learn one thing, it would be that Lillian doesn't understand what the word summary means.
It's okay. Cause we get little tasty tidbits to kind of tease our audience for what's coming in the discussions. My kind of little mini summary is twofold. One, that this is a swashbuckling epic of revenge and love.
Nice.
Written originally by Alexandre Dumas, classic guy. He also did The Three Musketeers. And adapted by Jay Wolpert, who is the writer who wrote the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Nice.
So I know from talking to our good friend who was on with us, Layla, who is like a fashion-obsessed and historical-obsessed person. She is not crazy about this because she loves the book in kind of a classic way of being like, this is so different from the novel.
Yes.
I started reading the novel because I love the movie so much, and that's what I saw first. And the story is unbelievably different, so I can totally understand if you were loyal to the original source material, it could get hard to like get into this. I would say this is a story kind of more inspired by the Count of Monte Cristo than like a loyal adaptation. But I loved finding out on one of the millions of rewatches that Sam and I watched this movie again, is that the guy who did the adaptation is the Pirates of the Caribbean guy. And I think he just writes like swashbuckling pirate stories very, very well. Because I am obsessed with like the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Everything after that, like interesting, not nearly as good. But if I think about Count of Monte Cristo and mm-hmm. the first Pirates film, I'm like, those are like peak pirate movies. And he wrote both of them. So
I'm going to need you to, I agree on Pirates of the Caribbean, big mm-hmm. fan. I need you to explain to me how you feel this whole movie is swashbuckling pirates, because damn, do they spend a lot of time in that prison though.
They sure do. But it's like, even though we have a lot of prison scenes, I mean, the beginning part, it's just very like nautical in setting. I mean, Edmund is a sailor. That's something that has always been like in his blood. That's like what he's really good at. And so, yeah, he begins as a sailor. He has like these kind of swashbuckling. There's that whole kind of sword fight, gunfight, when they get to the island at first. And then, of course, later he has all the interactions with the smugglers, essentially pirates. And then, once he becomes a fancy boy, we don't see it quite as much. Yeah, but it reemerges again. As he's seeking his revenge, he uses all his incredible pirate skills.
So before we go into it too much, mm-hmm. what about this movie makes it one of your like top movies of all time that you watch over and over again?
So a big part, I think, definitely has to do that I saw it at a very influential age. I watched this movie when I was like in elementary school, and I immediately like fell in love with it. I think part of it is just the sort of romantic, kind of grandiose sort of fantasy of it all. There's lots of things that was standing out to me when rewatching this, where I was like, this is very kind of melodramatic, over the top, in the way that everything is. But that's what I love about it, is that kind of classic epic. There's so many one-liners in this when I'm like, holy shit. I'm like, that's a bumper sticker. That is amazing. I could live my life by that line. But it's just like, I don't know. I think it has all of this over the top romance and tragedy and drama, and it's packaged in a very beautiful lens. I mean, because all the people in it are stunning, and I'm just like, oh, Jim Caviezel, like, hi. I think I fell in love with him at an age when a lot of other like tweens and teen girls were falling in love with like a Phantom of the Opera and stuff like that. So yeah. He was my moody revenge-seeking boy.
I love that you're like modern. Who else would you like be in love with? Is Phantom of the Opera?
Well, come on.
Piper's like, listen. I wasn't like all the other girls who loved drama. I liked Count of Monte Cristo, not Phantom of the Opera. I was thinking like Edward Cullen from Twilight. Like, yeah. That's the vibe. Piper's like, no. You know how you all, like, no matter what it is, you love an old man.
Who lusts over a weird girl. It's going to be great.
It's going to be great.
I don't know. I guess that's just the movie that stands out in my head to me. If you knew, like, a theater kid girl and she had a crush on a moody guy, it was probably The Phantom.
For sure.
Yeah.
And if you knew any 14-year-old when we were 14, mm-hmm. they also had a crush on Edward Cullen, unless they were too cool for school and they had a crush on the Count of Monte Cristo.
Yeah. Or Jacob Black.
That's true. Because they weren't like other girls.
Right. Exactly.
Oh, my God.
I liked that how much you talked about him being too sweet for this world, because I kind of, in my own little additional summary for this, I'm like, what if you took like the sweetest, kindest, dumbest boy and just took everything away from him and then made him like just hate the world and want only revenge?
Because it's not even that he's like, he's not dumb.
Right.
He's just so trusting.
Exactly.
He's like a little toddler walking through a supermarket and you're like, sweet pea, no.
So to go in some more detail, our movie begins when Edmond Dantès and his good friend, Fernand Mondego, they are on this ship. His captain has contracted brain fever and they are close to the island. And I'm not going to try and say what it was because I'm not certain 100%. But it's the island where Napoleon Bonaparte is being held prisoner by the British government. They just happen to be nearby when their captain got sick. So they go ashore asking for help. He fires a pistol to like get attention of these soldiers. Bad idea. They get like chased down and all this stuff.
That genuinely was like, that was the first moment that I was like, oh my God, you're so just like, he just honest to goodness. That's the thing is like, you think he's so dumb, but he just honest to goodness thought that if he got their attention, they'd come over and talk to him and do a help.
Well, exactly. And I think that's part of what makes Edmund's like journey so great is because he goes from such extremes. Like he goes from being a man who honestly thinks he can fire a gun on the beach where Napoleon's being held and be like, we can explain it though and everything's gonna be fine, they're not gonna shoot us on sight.
Listen, I just want to get their attention. And his friend is like, Jesus fucking Christ, don't do that.
He's
my
like,
guy,
I'm here too and I don't want to die because of this decision that you made. But yes, that is the treason that Lillian was kind of hinting towards, is that Napoleon Bonaparte's doctor is, you know, used to kind of treat their captain. They are held there overnight as his guests. And he identifies easily that Edmund is a very gullible, well-meaning person that he can take advantage of. So he asks him to deliver a letter to one of his old, like, army friends back on the mainland. Because he's like, oh, the British have this really annoying habit of reading my mail. And I wrote this really sensitive letter to an old war buddy.
It's just for a friend. And he's like, oh, that, you know what? As I think about that, I have no reason not to believe you.
Yeah, Emperor Napoleon.
You just, listen, it's hard to express your feelings. And I applaud you for being so brave.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's in these moments when we have introduced this narrative element that I am in love with, the whole chess piece, king of the moment kind of scene, where when one of them, because it's implied that they've been friends for a really long time, since they were children. And so they have this kind of thing that they do with one another, where if one of them kind of succeeds at doing anything, then the other will gift them this king chess piece. And they'll say that you are king of the moment.
Yes.
So that's introduced there.
And I do have to say, the first note that I made about the whole dynamic between this entire group is I felt like Edmund was in love with his captain. that was like a real vibe that I got, was that this man was like romantically in love with the captain of this ship. Because he like throws his body over him during the scene where he's unconscious and they're waiting for the doctor. And he's like risking his entire career to try to get this man's safe And I just think that maybe every single person that Edmund pre-prison sees, he's romantically in love with.
He's, what's that one song where it's like, I fall in love just a little bit every day with someone new? That's Edmund's theme song.
Someone new, I think, is the song. That's perfect. Except he's just deeply in love with everyone. It doesn't go away. He just romantically loves everyone.
Yeah,
and it's part of the reason he trusts them all.
Yeah.
So my experience of watching this was like, not know, like being like, what cool best friends? I bet these cool best friends could go on an adventure. So Guy Pearce is the man who plays, is it Ferdinand?
So it is Fernand.
Fernand. Who plays Fernand.
Yes.
I just get bad vibes from that actor. It's not his fault. He's a good actor. He does a good job playing somebody who gives bad vibes. Because he also plays a similar character in, I think it's Iron Man 2? Where he's like, I'm just a little nerd. And then he turns out to be an evil genius.
Guy Pearce is a bad guy in one of the Iron Man
movies.
Oh,
is it Iron Man 3?
It's the one where Gwyneth Paltrow gets a suit as well.
Yeah.
That's the one where he's the bad guy.
I think it's 3 that you're saying that. Because 2's the one where the guy has like the scary rope arms.
Yeah.
I had a crush on that guy. He also...
Sorry, of course I did.
I wish we could talk about anything else on the podcast, but we do need to unpack that legally.
He was big and scary and had a cool accent and a bird, and
oh
I liked him.
God. Piper.
We have famously always joked that my appeal of men are just like old guys with mashed potato faces. Mickey Rourke takes the cake when it comes to a man who literally had his face beaten to a pulp and then attempted to continue his acting career despite his facial deformities. And I'm like, yeah, but he's cool though.
Oh my God. Piper, you can't sneak that in the middle of a podcast. It's fundamentally changed my life.
That's why I do these things. For your entertainment.
Perfect. But the thing that I know Guy Pearce from the most, though, is Memento, which is a movie that I have never, not even for one single second, know how I feel about it. It's one of those movies that, like, has this insane reputation, feels like it. I should like it. And yet I never feel like I truly do. Anyway, that's my hot take on Memento.
I'm surprised. Have you seen Memento more than once then? Because that, again, doesn't really strike me as a Lillian film.
Oh, no. I watched it one time and did not. I didn't feel like watching it again.
Yeah. Because it seems like it's kind
definitely
of a
not a Lillian film.
Yeah.
And I think that the first half of this movie is not a Lillian film.
Of Monte Cristo?
Yeah, because you're just watching. I'm just like, what, a best friend and a fiance? Things are looking up.
Oh my God, I'm so glad you went in blind.
Oh, it felt like bullying a little bit.
Oh no.
But I did have a moment where I fully Googled, does Count of Monte Cristo have a happy ending? Because I was like, I swear to God, if I watch this man go through prison, he has to get the girl in the end. So they get back to the mainland after the sexual tension and becoming best friends with Napoleon, which the actor who played him, I didn't write down his name, but I Googled Napoleon afterwards to check the dates on when this was happening. He looks freakishly like Napoleon.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it was the costuming or the makeup or what, but he looks very historically accurate.
No, it was a great portrayal. I'm glad that they didn't do what so many people do where they're like, oh, he's famously short. Isn't that funny? And it's just like, no, they just cast a man who was like average to slightly short height and he did a great performance. So good job.
And he also has like a big personality. So it's hard to capture both of those things. Anyway, so they get back to the mainland. Edmund's going to get in trouble. So he gets called up to the owner of the ship's office. And what's his nut's best friend goes, finds Edmund's lady love.
Mercedes.
And it's just like, please just have sex with me. We don't have to tell him that you had sex with me. And that's when I started going, you might suck.
Yeah. Yeah. You couldn't tell from like some of his like sort of sketchy vibes earlier on, especially.
Well, his sketchy vibes I thought was because I was projecting previous things.
Okay. I see.
What moment were you going to say especially?
I think like the narrative visually really kind of clues that in when there's the handoff of the letter between Napoleon and Edmund, and the lens is zoomed in close on like the letter being exchanged. And then it like does a pan focus and you can see in the background that Fernand is there and he's like spying from the window and watching this happen.
See, yeah. I thought best friend just upset that secret being kept.
Yeah.
Because if you and I, which there's another pair of best friends that I would like to talk about later in the movie that I have very strong feelings about who is who. Mm-hmm. But we will talk about that when we cross that bridge. But cool. If I was in, okay, whether it's you or I, if one of us was in a house and the other one was getting a letter from Napoleon, we'd be watching through the window.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, we'd be like, what's going on out there? And then you come back and be like, anything cool happened? And if you were like, oh, no, just chatting, you know, with Napoleon. And I'd be like, okay. But see, I wouldn't betray you later.
That's the thing. I think the difference is that, like, because the big thing, and I'm going to do a little jump forward here about, I think, one of the beautiful things about why their relationship is so fascinating is because, as you say, when Fernand later takes Mercedes off to the rock and he's trying to seduce her and being all like rude behind the back of his good friend Edmund, and she makes this, she tells us this wonderful story about when they were kids, and she's like, "Do you remember when you got a pony for your birthday and Edmund got a whistle? You were so mad that he was happier with his whistle than you were with your pony, and I'm not going to be your next whistle." And it's like we have all these wonderful little like nuggets that are placed here, and also just the way that Guy Pearce like so wonderfully kind of portrays this sort of just below the surface kind of like, I hate you, but like we're friends and but I can't articulate why I hate you. And then it comes out in that moment, which is one of my favorite moments, when after so quick jump, little details here, we're hopping around. It is Danglar is the name of the first mate, and the ship guy is like, captain's dead. Normally, Danglar, you would become captain, but I think your actions were cowardly, that you didn't go ashore and take care of this. You let this boy do it instead. So now the boy is captain and you're going to remain under him. And Danglar is clearly like upset about this. And I'm like, you don't think that guy is going to obviously like murder Edmund while at sea and be like, whoops, there was a drowning.
Edmund would never suspect anyone of that. No. He's like, no, you couldn't. I could not. No one could ever. Well, why would they do that?
Of course, Edmund wouldn't suspect it. But the old man who's running the ship and can see this angry guy gritting his teeth be like, this isn't a good decision. Maybe I should have you working on different boats.
But, incredible.
So as captain, Edmund can now marry Mercedes because he needs his captain papers so he can support her and all this jazz.
And then we have the cutest scene of him running across some rocks and running up to Gross Friend, flirting with her and being like, oh my God, we're going to get married. You're going to be my best man. It's amazing. And they go have this romantic night together. And we have this beautiful shot that is like of them like skinny dipping together, but you're like seeing it from underneath. So you just see the silhouettes and it's truly gorgeous.
Yeah.
And then they like have this cute little fire and he talks about how he'll propose as soon as he can afford a ring. And she pulls off a piece of thread and puts it around her finger and says, it'll never leave my finger. And it doesn't.
It's so good. It's so good. That's another, I just think, Jay Wolpert wrote this so well. Like, there are so many, a lot of my favorite moments, I have not spotted them in the novel so far. And I'm like, I think these are all just him and they're gold and I love it. We also there get a little kind of like seed is also planted when Edmund is like kind of twirling his finger in his hair. And she's like, don't do that. You'll go bald. Because it's apparently a thing he does all the time. That's going to come up later.
It comes back, you guys.
Okay, so angry best friend decides to team up with angry, drunk, old first mate. And they're like, let's freaking betray him. Because Fernand is like...
Which I think that's the main line that people say right before they do a betray. Yeah. They're like, let's freaking betray him.
Let's freaking betray him. Because it's like 7 a.m. in the morning and Fernand is drinking on the docks. And there's his other buddy. And he's like, I've been here for hours. Sit down. Know any secrets we can use to get this guy? And he's like, I got a juicy one for you. He took a letter from Napoleon. She didn't hear it from me. So anyway.
And also, from my perspective through this whole thing, I was like, you, Fernand, you can't. Because I was like still not convinced that he was the main villain. Ooh. So I was like, oh my God, maybe he's like just mad in this moment and drunk and making a bad decision and didn't mean to betray him. Mm-hmm. So I'm like still bought into these guys are best friends.
Oh, dude. Lillian, you got the ultimate experience because just like Edmund, you felt that full betrayal of having your earth shattered when you realized that he was a dick.
I really did.
Oh. So, on his wedding night, Edmund is taken away. He is brought into custody, arrested.
They don't get married.
No, they're supposed to be engaged, but I'm mixing some details from the book. In the book, it is his wedding night, and he's taken away before that can happen. But in this, it's just a little party with his fiance and his dad. But yeah, he's arrested. They won't tell him what the charges are. He's brought before a character that I love, who is...
An ass? I think that's his name. Senor, I'm an asshole prosecutor?
I know it's Vilfort is his last name, so we'll just call him Vilfort. Yeah. And he has this, like, wonderful moment where Vilfort, you know, figures out, like, what's going on with the letter. He reads it. He's like, well, that's treachery. What the heck are you doing? And he has this whole cute moment of like, no, I'm just an innocent bean. I don't even know how to read or write. So I couldn't know what was in the letter, all this stuff. And I think it's such a great time of Vilfort looking at him and genuinely just being like, yeah, no, you're not guilty of this. You're a fool, but I intercepted the letter. So no harm done. You can go. Oh, wait one second. I should probably do my job and figure out who is this supposed to go to. Oh, wait, my father? He doesn't say that out loud, but like his dad is the Napoleonic sympathizer who is supposed to receive this letter and cause a shit ton of problems.
It's the first time that I'm like watching Edmund and I'm like, I can't believe you're going to get away with, like, you're going to get out of this. Like, he's walking out the door and I was like, they're not going to let him go, right? And then it's that last moment when he turns back and says the name. And as soon as he starts burning the letter, I'm like, run, run right now. Run away. Yeah. Run. He's destroying evidence.
Yeah.
Run away.
Which I love that later Dumbledore has to spell that out for him. And he's like, ah, he burned the letter. And he's like, yeah, isn't that standard procedure? Oh, wait a second.
He's like, fully. Like, what happened? I don't know. I said the name and then he changed his mind. And he's like, okay. And then he tells the story for what seems to be like the 100th time. And is like, and then he burned the letter and he goes, hold on. He burned the letter? You never shared that with me before? He was covering up a crime.
Oh gosh. I have a thing here too where I'm like, oh yeah, you could borrow my carriage. Don't mind the steel bars and that you're getting in from the back. It's like, Eddie!
As soon as he says you can borrow my carriage, I was like, well, don't get in it.
Yeah.
don't do that. And then he goes out the back door and he's like, no, I still believe that this is fine. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he like fully gets into the carriage, sees the bars and is just like, this all seems totally normal and fine to me. And it's not until they get out, they take him out of the carriage and start transporting him to a prison that he's like, I was supposed to go home. You guys clearly misunderstood what was said, but I'm supposed to go home.
Well, there is, I think at least once he's in there and the door closes and he hears the lock, that's when he's like, starts to get nervous and afraid because he does kind of go to the bars. He's like, Mr. Vilfort, not that I don't love your carriage, but it's kind of aggressive. What's going on?
It's kind of aggressive. Oh my God.
So yeah, they tell him that he's going to go to the Chateau d'If. He fights off some guards, steals a horse, and runs to sanctuary at his best friend's house. But
And if you're me, you're going, I don't think this is a great idea because that man was at least partially responsible for your being here. So we can't trust him fully, and he feels betrayed by you. And then it turns out, big betrayal. Main betrayal.
Huge betrayal. Okay, so there are several fight scenes in this movie. This, I think, technically you could call it the second one because the first one happens on the beach when they go to, I just want to say, like, Napoleon's house.
Yeah, which is accurate.
So this is the second fight scene. And what I love so much about this scene, it may be probably my favorite one in the whole movie, is that it's clear that because Fernand is like a nobleman, he has been trained with the sword and he is an able-bodied fencer. And so he uses this easily to attack his friend. And at first, Edmund is running away from him. He's confused. He's hurt. He like just madly grabs at a sword and tries to defend himself. He knows nothing of how to do this. And he's just so frightened, shocked, and heartbroken that for him, it's just this like mad, like wild fighting. And at one point, like Fernand easily like gets the sword out of his hand, puts his sword in Edmund's face, and Edmund goes and grabs the blade as if to he's like, come on, stop this. And he like, of course, pulls it out, slices his hand, and then instantly like goes and gives him a few more cuts. Like just
it
to
was
be mean.
Brutal.
Oh.
And he kept saying things like, don't make me cut off your hand. And like when they first started sword fighting, my notes go as follows. They first start sword fighting. I'm like, why don't we resolve all conflicts with sword fights? And then he starts cutting him. And I was like, that doesn't seem fun anymore. It was fun when they were just doing like the let's hit each other with swords, like our swords hit each other part. That's how my brothers and I used to fight with Christmas paper rolls. But when they started cutting each other, I no longer found it fun.
Yeah. And I think it's like, so this whole night has been terrifying for Edmund, but I think this is the most, like, the deepest cut of all. Literally, his friend shedding his blood and seeming so cool and detached about it, this person yeah. who he thought was his closest friend. And it's like, this is one of my favorite chunks of dialogue in a movie that has nothing but good dialogue, mm-hmm. where Edmund, on his knees, cries out in agony. He's like, why? In God's name, why? And Fernand just goes, because you're the son of a clerk, and I'm not supposed to want to be you. And I'm like, oh, God, that's such a good motivation for being a total ass. Like, not justified, but awesome.
It was, yeah, because it's so the like, rage of prejudice and mm-hmm. racism of like, I'm mad at you because how I feel when I look at you, mm-hmm. which is like fucking insane, but also exactly what happens when people are this nuts.
But also there's this idea too that how he ends it, I'm not supposed to want to be you. Because yeah. I think Fernand, despite his prejudice and like jealousy and pettiness, he admires how good of a person Edmund is. And I think he sees that he's like, I'm not that. Like, I'm not brave. I'm not being recognized for, like, you know, my accomplishments like Edmund is. He just became captain. He has this girl who's wonderful, who loves him. I'm the wealthy lord. I should be the happy one that people look up to. Why do I want to be this guy?
And I also think there is the, like, good relation. Like, he clearly has a good relationship with his dad. Mm-hmm. He has all of these people who like him. And he's, like, in addition to, like, being a good person, he has, like, love and all these other things. And I obviously, this man does not have a good relationship with his father, as evidenced by, spoiler alert, he participates in a let's kill each other's dad pact.
Yes.
And so, like, he's told that this is supposed to make you happy, that having all of this money and this power and all of these things is supposed to be what you want, and that's the good thing. Mm-hmm. And then he sees evidence in his best friend of the whistle is better, mm-hmm. and it pisses him off.
Exactly. So now we have what I assume is Lillian's least favorite part of the movie.
I hated it. I hated every single second until Dumbledore came up through the floor, and then I thought it was fine.
So did you hate that Chateau d'If's warden is a literal Dracula?
I hated that so much.
He looks like a Dracula stereotype.
I will say the only part of it that I enjoyed was when he walks in and he goes, I'm innocent. And the guy goes, I believe you. Mm-hmm. I believe that everybody here is innocent, because if you weren't innocent, they would send you somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, weird philosophy. Oh, you're just a full-fledged sadist.
Yeah.
Okay. I did the whip him once a year scenes mm-hmm. were a little too realistic for Lillian. Mm-hmm. So I did skip forward for every single one because it made me for real sad.
There you go. Jim Caviezel wins the award for the king of getting whipped on movies. Because he also played Jesus in The Passion of the Christ, where he literally gets whipped for 45 minutes. And they're like,
no.
I don't know which one came first, but I'm allowed to imagine they're like, hey, Jim, you know, we really liked you in that whipping scene, although it was a little too short for us. Do you want to do this again for 5 hours?
Incredible. This was first. This was 2 years before.
Amazing.
Incredible.
This was his audition tape to be in Passion of the Christ.
Oh my God.
Incredible.
But then Dumbledore comes up through the floor.
Yes. And when we say Dumbledore, we're talking about, and I don't have his name in front of me. It's like Richard Harris. Isn't that his name?
Richard Harris is the actor.
Yes.
He played Dumbledore in the first two Harry Potter movies.
Yes.
And I wouldn't have picked out his face necessarily, but the second that he talked, I was like, Dumbledore?
Yeah. For me, he's OG. I know, of course, he originated the role, but I like him way better than the other guy who came in. Mm-hmm. But that guy had big shoes to fill, and Richard Harris is a gem. So,
yeah,
he was here. He plays the priest who teaches Edmund how to read, write, do mathematics, learn about economics, do philosophy, speak multiple languages. I love at one point, he's like, it's not enough, old man. Teach me the sword. And he's like, I'm so old. Like, can I just sleep, please? And he's like, no. If you want me to help you dig this escape tunnel, then you teach me how to kill people now.
My favorite line was when he did the math on how long it was going to take them to dig the tunnel. Mm-hmm. And he goes, it's going to take 8 years. And he's like, oh my God. And he goes, what? Do you have another something else to do with your time?
Yeah.
You too busy to dig the escape tunnel, my guy.
Well, it's so good, too, when he first comes in there and Edmund is freaking out because he hasn't seen a human face in, like, 5 years. And his, like, first little thing that he says, he just sort of whispers. He's like, there are, you know, I don't know, 8,000 some hundred stones in my cell. I've counted them many times. And with, like, the coolness of a cucumber, Dumbledore leans in and he's like, ah, but have you named them yet? And he just starts breaking down and crying. And he's like, I'm sorry, I joked. I should be more chill.
I also didn't like the realism of how they got their tools, mm-hmm. specifically the candles, mm-hmm. specifically watching them trap rats yeah. so they could eat them and then turn some of the leftover bits into candles.
Yeah, well, they use their skulls as, like, the basis for the candle.
Yucky.
Yeah, he also cuts off his little beard hairs to, like, light the candles and stuff. They're very innovative.
They're very innovative, and I hated it.
So, Lillian, one of my questions that I wrote down for you is, if you found yourself trapped in the Chateau d'If for 13 years, what would be just some of the activities that you would do to pass your time?
Listen, I don't want to be a bummer, but I wouldn't make it. So, time would be passed finding a different kind of escape.
Let's say you're going to be there for a month. How do you pass your 1 month in solitude?
I would tell myself stories mm-hmm. to the point where I would, because sometimes we've talked about Piper's vivid imagination. My imagination also quite vivid. And you'd come pick me up after that month and be like, so how was it?
And you're like, first of all, you are now my Fernand because you put me in prison.
You'd be like, wasn't my choice, but I did promise to be a ride home. And I would be like, I am unsure of what is real and what is not anymore. Like, that's how vivid my imagination would end up being. How about yours? What would you do?
I would 1000% be singing day and night. I am not, like, a talented singer, but I love to sing. And so I would be the person, I'm sure the guards would hate me, but I'd be in there all the time. Not only just, like, singing, but I'm also that person who, like, I'll get, like, one lyric stuck in my head. And after singing it a few times, I'm like, I'm good at singing this lyric. And I'll just sing it over and over and over again. And sometimes Sam has the misfortune of being in the house. And he's like, you really need to stop. And I'm like, I'm sorry. But if I'm in my prison cell, I can sing to my heart's content. Yeah. They dig this whole tunnel. They get close enough that they find plant roots, which means they're close to the surface. But there is a collapse. Old man dies. Oh, while he's in there, he's telling him the reason he's in prison is because he was in the Napoleonic army, burned down a church of people inside, felt really bad, repented, worked for this really holy guy who had a big fortune. That guy died. Napoleon wanted his money, and he said he didn't know where the treasure was, so they put him in jail to refresh his memory. So then, when he's dying, he's like, oops, I lied. Here's a map to the treasure. Use it for good. Only for good. And he's like, no, you old dummy. I'm going to use it for my revenge. It's all I've talked about since we've met. And he's like, okay. And dies.
Well, and he said a line that I thought was really interesting as a philosophy, which is, don't commit the crime for which you've been accused.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is a really interesting idea of, like, don't become the thing that they said you were.
Yeah.
Like, they said you did a murder and a mm-hmm. betrayal. Don't go out of here and do a murder betrayal. And I was like, oh, that's going to be really interesting to watch him thread that needle. Mm-hmm. And then at the very end, he's like, I would do just one murder.
Well, Lillian, this unfortunately is not that kind of story. This is the kind of edgy, dramatic story where the innocent guy says, you want me to be the monster? Fine, I'll be the monster. And then he becomes a cool dude.
Which I should have known, because Piper loves somebody who's a little bit a monster.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Just a little bit of a monster.
Life was mean to him. He's got to be mean back.
Yeah.
Okay, so then he kills the warden. He escapes by pretending to be a dead body in the bag, swims to shore because he's an excellent swimmer from being a sailor, and then he meets the wonderful smugglers.
And says one of my favorite lines.
Yeah, tell us, what is it?
So the captain of the smuggler, he gets brought to the captain of the smugglers as he's celebrating on the beach, and they all look at him like, dude, what the hell? And the captain of the smugglers is like, hey, I have this problem. Jacob or whatever.
Jacopo.
Jacopo mm-hmm. he did a steal, so I have to bury him alive. You know how it is.
Yep.
One of those classic problems that all managers have. But my men want me to give him mercy, so I'm going to balance that out by letting him fight you to the death so I can be merciful. And also, one of you can have a job afterwards. By the way, he's like the best knife fighter I've ever met. So mm-hmm. just be emotionally prepared for that. And he's like, if you don't do this, and if you win, you get to be a smuggler. And he goes, what if I don't want to be a smuggler? And he goes, then I will kill you. And he goes, you know, I find the smuggling life is for me.
And I'd be delighted to kill your friend, the maggot.
And it's incredible.
It is incredible. They have this great sword fight. He easily defeats him and then does this amazing, he just convinces them. That's the one thing is that, like, I'm like, for a man who's been in prison for 13 years, whose only company has been this old man, you are very charismatic for someone who otherwise has been in essentially solitary confinement. I feel like you wouldn't be able to form normal sentences.
Well, because he was always pretty charismatic. And I also do like the subplot in our heads that maybe he has fully lost his mind and he's just sort of delusional. And that's why everyone's giving him this space, is because he sounds fucking nuts. But then what is his name?
Jacopo. Yes.
Jacopo, I made the mistake of looking at it instead of just remembering it. Hmm. Then go, like, after he essentially negotiates for his life, mm-hmm. basically goes, I'm yours forever now. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk more about the rest of the plot, but this is Lillian's one little tangent of the show. Because I have decided of this best friendship, who you and I each would be in this.
Tell me.
And I have my reasons for each. But I'm curious, as a gut check, which one do you think we would each be?
Oh, man. I feel like... I think I might be your Jacopo.
That's very cute and wrong.
Okay.
Because the whole time I was watching this, the dramatic flair to be the Count of Monte Cristo is something that only one P. Cleavey could handle.
Maybe I was just trying to be modest with my answer.
The only way that you can pull off a robe like this man chooses to wear for most of the second half of this movie, that the whole time I'm going, that's insane. No one would wear that. Oh my God, Piper would wear that and she would love it and she would die.
Dude, it's so funny you say that because I was literally thinking to myself, I'm like, I both want to be Edmond Dantes and want to be loved by Edmond Dantes.
Yes. So I would be your Jacopo, though, because mm-hmm. he says one of my favorite lines later in the movie when he's doing some meddling. Mm-hmm. And he says, I will protect you with my life, even if it's protecting you from yourself, mm-hmm. which is an arrogance that only I possess. I possess the arrogance to be like, listen, I've decided this is what's best for you. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to let you be dramatic and run around being a count. But I'm going to decide that you should have this lady love.
So you can be my Jacopo, but only if you promise that when I'm super depressed on an island sitting on a pile of gold, that you offer the solution of like, who are your enemies? I'll kill them. Bang, 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 bang. We spend the treasure. How is this a bad plan? You have to promise to do that for me, even when I'm going to say no, because that's what I need emotionally.
Of course. Of course. I would love to kill your enemies.
Thank you. Same.
You just have to find us a big treasure.
Oh, yeah. I'm working on it. I already have the map. I just have to decode it.
Perfect.
Okay, so he sails around with the smugglers for a while, gets some street cred, and then like works off his time with them. They get back to Marseille, and he's now going to go try to find his family. And he finds out that his father killed himself after learning of his conviction. Super
Which
sad.
Is like, this to me felt like, why are you making it worse? I was already sad, and now he's finally going to get, things are going to turn around, and you're like, hey, Lillian, you know that open wound we just gave you? And I'm like, yeah? And they're like, we'd love to put a little salt in it.
Just a little taste on the rim.
Just a little bit, so you actually are like, no, for real, these guys have to die and suffer.
Yes. So his dad killed himself. His fiance ran off with the man who betrayed him, so now she is on the murder list. And the old man who was his friend has like kind of run on hard times, but he gave him information, not knowing that he was Edmund. So Edmund gives him a little bag of gold and he's like, let's go find this treasure. It's time to seek revenge.
Which was also a great way to like have it be somebody who he thought of as a father figure, not recognizing him.
Yeah.
Made him have the confidence to be like, oh, nobody's going to recognize me.
Yeah. And I guess I could talk about this now, but one thing that I think is really interesting, and it's something that I see a lot of people kind of pick at in movies and shows and stuff, when an actor plays the same character but they don't do anything to like change their face really, apart from like, so here Edmund has a full beard and longer hair and also just a bit older. But otherwise, if you put him next to young Edmund, you'd still be like, oh, that's the same person. And so the criticism of why do these people who know him not recognize him? The thing that I think is so interesting is that the truth that they understand is that Edmund Dantès is dead. So mm-hmm. even if he like stood right in front of them, they're not going to jump to the conclusion, oh, this is that boy that died a long time ago. If anything, you might think to yourself, this person reminds me of that individual, but it's not this person because I know that they're dead and that's a truth. This is just something else. So your brain for isn't sure. looking for that. But what I think is so interesting is that when he sees Mercedes for the first time, mm-hmm. she's the only person who's instantly like, holy shit, it's you. And I yeah. think what's so great about that is everyone else is just going off of the idea that this person is dead and how could they possibly be anywhere else. She, I think, is constantly thinking of Edmund mm-hmm. and longing for him and wanting to see him again. So when he's there, she's like, that's you. You're Edmund Dantès. You're my love. And so I love yeah. that so much.
Yeah, I also felt like they did a really good job. The other thing, too, is like they did a good job of making him seem like his whole demeanor changed, too. It's yeah. like when he was Edmund, he was so light and he had these bright, like trusting eyes and his whole face was just like so open. And then just like making his hair a little longer and a little scragglier and giving him this beard and adding this layer of like skepticism on top of someone whose whole personality was just trust and innocence, yeah. I think really changed the way that he looked. But I think, yeah, the idea that Mercedes was able to see right through that and see to his true heart.
Absolutely.
Was so good.
So they find an island full of treasure. He becomes a count. He decides, I'm going to go murder all these people, but we can't just put a bullet in their head. We have to study them. We must make them suffer as
they
I
must suffer as I have suffered.
It's so good. And that's, yeah, when Jacopo's like, if you're going to do all this, you can't have a name that essentially means driftwood. And he's like, then yeah. I will become a count. And it's like so great. Lillian, do you want to describe the grand entrance that he makes?
It's so unbelievably, this was a peak only peak Levy. Like, there's no way I could do that. Peak Levy could do it though.
I could do it.
So, first of all, Jacopo shows up with just like a crate full of gold at this guy's mansion and is like, this is mine now. This is mine. Mm-hmm. And the guy just fully leaves, doesn't pack anything up, just takes his crate full of gold and goes bye-bye with the most prop looking gems I've ever seen. You couldn't make them a little shiny, guys. They had to be clearly plastic.
It's cute.
So then they buy this house. They have a whole fancy party. They invite everybody over to this party in this yard. Fireworks go off. Then there's a hot air balloon. Then out of the hot air balloon drop four, like, what would we call them? Gymnasts?
Silk dancers?
Silk dancers, sure. And they do a little dance as it starts to float down. And then they end up on the ground and they drag it down. And then we see the very top of his head. And then he stands and somebody opens the door and he walks down steps and he goes, hello, I'm the Count of Monte Cristo. And you're like, Jesus fucking Christ.
So amazing. I love it. Oh my gosh. And now I wonder why I'm like an adult. And I'm like, I just feel like life isn't special enough. Like, where are the hot air balloon entrances I was promised?
Is that how you're going to come down right before you come down the aisle at your wedding?
Oh my
you're
God.
You're like, listen, Sam, I know it's not in the budget, but it feels right. Doesn't it just feel right that I would come down in a hot air balloon?
It's like, look, I was going to do the elephants, but they're booked. So it's got to be a balloon.
Uh-huh. Oh my God.
The people that he really wanted to impress were not there. And this is where we get to see how the life that his enemy is living along with Mercedes is not all that great. Fernand is actively cheating on her and then killing the husbands of his mistresses.
Which, like, geez, he's like, listen, I did have to kill him because he made you upset because you were totally fine not knowing that I was sleeping with other people. Everybody was happy until this guy decided to air it out. So I had to do a murder.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's the way it's got to be. And then we find out that they have a kid, which did your jaw drop when you recognized who that boy is.
So fast. I was like, holy shit, what is Henry Cavill doing here?
It's baby Henry Cavill.
This was his second movie ever.
Cute.
He was 19 and he looks 12.
He's very wee, at least compared to the giant mountain of a man that he has become.
I will say this was the only twist that I immediately picked up on.
Yes. Because
they were like, 15 years. I'm like, oh, that's his son. Yeah. That's Edmund's son for sure.
Also, when we see Edmund at the very end of the movie and he's like all clean shaven and he's like standing on the cliff, it's a dead
ringer.
They
look spooky. Like, because they did, that was incredible casting.
Yeah.
And it was so well done that like, she had this really dark hair, and so, like, it could have been that's where he got those looks from. Like, it wasn't like, you're both blonde and your child has dark hair, my guy. What did you think was happening? Yeah. Like, it wasn't one of those. It was like, oh, well, her hair just is what he ended up getting. Where, like, anytime you saw those two together, I was like, it's father and son for sure.
Yeah. So Edmund decides that he can use their kid as a way to like get close to them and like enact his revenge, which we gotta take a quick sexy tangent break because for me, seeing
no, hold on. Stop the podcast. You guys need to know, Piper just grabbed one side of her glasses, did a little glasses raise and scoot, and said, For me.
Seeing like Edmund sleeping on the floor because he's spent so many years in a prison, he can't sleep in a plush bed anymore. And he rolls over and we see all the scars on his back. Again, I'm like, I don't need no phantom. I got this tragic bastard. He owns my heart.
Piper's like, I'll sleep on the floor with you.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a definite sexual awakening for me. Every time I see it. Oh, yeah. I forgot I've been to ex-cons with lots of money.
Oh my god.
Okay, so he plans this big elaborate thing because what's the boy's name? I've been so good with names so far.
Henry Cavill.
We'll just call him Henry Cavill. Henry Cavill is going to Rome with his little boyfriends. And he gets
his little boyfriends.
Yeah, his little boyfriends. And he gets seduced by a lady, led into these catacombs, and is kidnapped by these guys.
That is another moment where you're like, that's Edmund's son. Only Edmund's son would be dumb enough to follow somebody away from a party and be like, no, the pretty girl wouldn't hurt me.
Yes, no, exactly. I saw the exact same thing. It's so good. And they're like, oh, yeah, we need some ransom, but a letter's going to take too long, so we're going to mail them your ring while still attached to your finger. Then a mysterious man shows up and he like fights off the bad guys and he sends the boy away. But then he's like, good job, gentlemen. And he gives him a little bag of gold and it's his friends, the smugglers. And they're like, ha, happy to help. And then he goes to this whole thing of like, you know, befriending the boy and convincing him to get invited and like dropping little information that he can feed back to his father.
And I did for just one single second go, why are you saying these things in front of the boy child? And then I figured it out. Later, I was like, oh, this is a trap. This is the trap. I got you. I'm with you now.
Too bad Edmund didn't put two and two together to be like, huh, this boy is familiar. I'm going to do this again. How do you say it's familiarly, whatever. He's like me. He's a dummy like I used to be.
He's like me.
So I can give him this info and he'll definitely familial give it to his dad.
Familial resemblance? Is that what you meant?
I'm trying to say familiar, but familiarly. It's, I can't do this word. This is why
it's so close.
Why do I have a podcast?
Listen, it's not our fault. You guys keep listening. We're thrilled about it. Don't get me wrong. But we are always, always surprised.
Okay, so finally, he gets to come face-to-face with the people he's been really wanting to hurt. And he gets invited to Albert. That's his name. Albert's birthday. And that's mostly where he seems like a little boy. Because he's like, come to my birthday party. And there's like presents and all kinds of stuff there. And they have a castle cake. And I'm like, oh, you little kid. It's cute.
He's just 15.
Yeah.
He shouldn't have been allowed to go on that trip by himself.
But here we have, of course, that amazing moment where Edmund and Mercedes see each other again. Edmund just blatantly like flirts with her in front of Fernand. And I love that Albert is like, isn't he great, Dad?
Such a great line of, I'm going to steal your wife.
Yes. And he He's like, wait, what? And he's like, for the waltz.
Just for the dance in a totally normal way.
So the entire night she's like staring at him and she's like, I feel like you're my dead fiance that I'm obsessed with, but that can't be, right? And then we have one of my all-time favorite moments in the whole movie, which is where Fernand is such a dick that he refuses to stick around and give the father's toast at Albert's birthday. So Mercedes has to go and do the toast herself, which I guess in this like society is shameful and embarrassing or whatever. And it's obvious that her husband is like just being an ass and is absent. And everyone can see that. And even though Edmund has solidified it in his mind and kind of his heart, he's like, this lady's dead to me. I've sworn that I'm going to seek revenge on both of them, but I can't stand by and let her be treated this way. So he steps in to save her like embarrassment and gives the toast himself.
And I also think he actually likes the kid. Like, I think that there's this reluctant actually like, and he's like, and I think he's, there's enough of that good person left that he's like, this child isn't responsible for the horrible crimes that his parents have committed against me. Little does he know.
Ooh.
He's like, I can't tell why I feel so fatherly towards this boy.
I know. And it's so cute. I hadn't really noticed this before, but at the end of the speech, Albert is like on the verge of tears. And I think it's because he's never had
baby Henry Cavill.
Yeah, because he's never had a real father figure before. And here's this guy who's like, this guy's so cool. He saved my life. And now he gave this awesome speech at my birthday. Which, if you may indulge me, I have to quote the end of that, because it's such a cool line. Where he says, life is a storm, my young friend. You will bask in the sunlight one moment, be shattered on the rocks the next. What makes you a man is what you do when that storm comes. You must look into that storm and shout as you did in Rome. Do your worst, for I will do mine. And then the fates will know you as we know you, as Albert Mondego, the man. It's so good. And I'm like,
oh, so good.
Amazing. Thank you for everything this movie's given us.
Yeah.
Well, then you want to give us some more quick action moments here?
I don't know anything that happens before they go in the carriage and there's the surprise in the carriage.
Yes.
The moment of Jacopo's most arrogant moment where he lets the pretty lady into the carriage and she's like, you're cute and I missed you, where have you been? And then she says Edmond over and over to him and he's like, I'm not Edmond. And then when she gets out, he says, I'm not Edmond, and then also says his last name and she's like, I never said the last name. Da da da
da da da. Exactly. And yeah, we do have that great moment when Jacopo has to save him even from himself, because he's like, you have this fortune, you have this woman, take the money, take the girl and live your life. And he's like, I can't. And it's all this great ball of rage, which again, another thing, this movie was so influential about what I look for in a fictional love. Because like, I'm also like, oh, like he was so tempted by having the woman he loves there in the carriage and he kept his cool until she left. And then you can tell that he's like holding all this rage beneath the surface and he's so tortured and I love him. So he then has a very busy night of enacting all of his revenges on people. He traps the guy from the shipping company because he got him to like be the one to take away his gold and then caught him trying to steal it. So that guy, he literally like tries to fight and murder this nobleman in front of a bunch of armed guards. It's like, that's not gonna go well for you. So then Edmund like gets him all tied up in a noose and reveals that he is Edmund Dantes right before he pushes him off the boat,
which was incredible.
Yeah,
very well done. Good job.
Awesome.
Flair for the dramatic never ends.
It's so good. Hence swashbuckling. He also gets Villefort by cornering him in a bathhouse and like keeps turning up the heat and like asking him all these hot questions, and he's like, I'm too hot, I don't want to answer your questions anymore, until he confesses the truth.
And then he's like, no, he's not, he's the one who pulled the trigger, he's never gonna admit that. And he's like, but you just did.
The ultimate fuck you, in my opinion, is when he puts him in like the exact same, presumably like jailed carriage, and then but inside he leaves him a pistol to like,
that was so fucked up.
Dude, it's savage. He leaves him a pistol as if, oh, you can take your life so you don't have to go live in Chateau d'If like I did. And he puts it in his mouth, pulls the trigger, nothing happens. And then Edmund's little face appears in the box and he's like, you didn't think I'd make it that easy, did you?
I'm like, that is brutal. That was the most... I actually think maybe you did lose your fucking mind and maybe you don't need a happy ending. Maybe this is just like a revenge and then we're done sort of situation. I was like, this is dark.
It is so savage. So after a long night of getting revenge on these guys, He goes back to his house exhausted, and who is there waiting for him but beautiful Mercedes, who's like, yo, you said Edmond Dantes. It is you. I need some answers. They have a very romantic, silhouetted, like, back and forth. And again, one of my favorite lines is when, you know, she keeps pushing and, like, all this stuff. And he says, don't rob me of my hate. It's all I have. Ugh. And I love it. A big thing that we haven't talked about in this is that in prison, he lost his faith in God. And then here, she's like, no, he's everywhere, even in a kiss. And they smooch. And it's just like that in the movie.
Guys, honest to God, uncanny. Piper is so good at that. It's like spooky.
Oh my God. So then he decides that he's going to take Mercedes and her son away, but not before he goes and kills his one friend. And yeah, we get to the old estate where Fernand has stolen, presumably, some of the Count's money, only to find that he knew he was going to do that, so the chests are empty except for a king's piece.
And then he reveals himself.
Yeah.
He steps through a wall, and he doesn't have a beard anymore, and suddenly you know who he is, because there's the king's piece, and then there's this. And I also think another thing they did really well was whatever they did to Fernand's makeup to make him slowly look, like, more and more, like, ill.
Yeah,
like he wasn't taking care of himself to the point where his, like, whole body was collapsing. They did a very good job of that.
Yeah.
And he's like, this is gonna be no problem. I've beaten your ass before with a sword. And then he pulls the sword out and they start fighting, and he's like, aha, no.
He's like, Dumbledore taught me to fight, bitch, like, you're going down. And he almost kills him, but then Albert runs in. It's kind of, this moment I think is like one of the weakest in the film. It's still good, but it feels a little too much like the chaotic ending of a play, where my note is literally the gang's all here because Edmund confronts Fernand, then Albert runs in, Edmund is about to kill Albert, but then boom, there's Mercedes, and then oops, also here we have Jacopo, and they're all there, and it's this whole big, like, reveal of truth. She lets him know that Albert is actually the son of Edmond Dantes, the man you know as the Count of Monte Cristo, and it's this great big moment, and Edmund's like, I have a son, maybe I shouldn't commit murder now. Let's forget all of this. And Fernand's like, I'm gonna put a bullet where it's gonna do the most harm, because I only have one left. And he shoots Mercedes in the shoulder, and he hops in his little pony, and he rides away. But then he's like, wait, no, I'm still a jealous asshole. I can't be happy if you have everything and I have nothing, so let's fight, actually.
I will say, it didn't feel too contrived that they all ended up there, because the idea that the son would, like, figure out that this is happening and show up makes sense to me. The idea that he left a note for his mom is very, very cute.
It's very cute.
And very indicative of this 15-year-old being 15. He's like, well, I'm going to just tell mom where I'm going.
It's like, I think
Dad's
in trouble.
Gone to save dad from duel. Be back by 2. Love your only good boy.
Please keep a hot pocket warm for me. I won't be long.
I will. I know I left a hot pocket in the microwave. I'm coming back for it. I liked that they did a moment where Jacoba, or whatever his actual name is, because I keep adding weird syllables to it, like, throws the knife, and so the bullet, like, skews off and hits her shoulder. Mm-hmm. I was feeling when Edmund decided to go out there and duel asshole, I felt like he was like something bad was going to happen, because that felt like the plot element that would happen there, is that, like, somehow she would die while he was gone. Very Megan Hercules. And I was glad that that didn't happen. I also noted a peak Levy moment, which is he takes his jacket off for the final duel, and he has a vest and billowy sleeves.
Yes, indeed. I have a note about that, too. The perfect way to fight.
My final note is twofold. One, during the duel, when he wins and does a stab through, they have a little bit of guts coming out. Yuck.
Lillian says, icky on this scene. No, thank
you. Gross. I didn't like it. And then the second thing that they did really well, but also made me kind of sad, was, like, the kid comes out and he's watching the man he always thought was his father and the man he admires and just found out is his father duel. And the death at the end, he like falls to his knees in front of the man he thought was his father. And my big note from that is, damn, that kid needs therapy.
Yes, for sure. Oh my gosh. I really loved the way that scene was filmed. This is my second favorite sword fight in the movie. And one thing that stood out to me, so there's a technique that's used to make things seem faster, where if characters are running in one direction or if like a car is driving in one direction at top speed, the camera comes at them from the opposite direction, also going fast. And with that dual momentum, it creates this very fast sense of motion. So they did that a couple of times with some of these scenes where they're kind of running back and forth in this field, fighting with each other. But the other thing that I loved is that this was filmed very low to the ground in this tall grass. So mm-hmm. that also added all this other layer of movement, and it like really put the ruins of this old estate like center in the background. So it's just beautiful. It's beautifully filmed fight scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. And right. Did you notice this? Right when he stabs him, there's a rainbow behind him. Did you see the rainbow?
No, I didn't.
That was totally like just happened in real life. And I was like, oh my God, what a stroke of luck.
I love that. That's so good.
My last note here is that when he's on, they go back to Chateau d'If, I think just to visit it because they've bought it. And he's like, I'm closing this prison down. No one else will suffer here. He's standing there clean shaven and he says, you were right, priest. You were right. And it's like, not really. I feel like this movie.
Yeah, not even a little bit at all.
I feel like this movie said a man like pursued his revenge, killed all the people who did him wrong, and then lived happily ever after. It's just like, there's no lesson here.
It's like, if you were right, that would be if you didn't kill anybody yeah. and just let everybody else live their life. You were right, priest. I think the only thing that made sense to me was like, that wasn't what made his life feel fulfilled,
mm-hmm.
which I would have, if I was going to play that moment, I would have played it in the moment after the death, he's devastated.
Mm-hmm.
And then they cut forward years in the future and he's doing good things and he has his family and he feels fulfilled.
Yeah.
And that's the moment where I would say you were right.
Yeah.
Because immediately after you got your revenge yeah. and then you also get your happy ending is not a you were right moment for the priest.
I'm glad we kind of felt the same on that one. I was like, I feel like this movie taught little Piper to go after people who are mean to her.
Which, like, to be fair, has been great for me.
Yeah, because it means I help out my friends.
We haven't done any murder revenges.
No.
Just shy of murder is sort yeah. of where our revenge sits, in case anyone's wondering, thinking about betraying us.
Yeah, so don't even think about stop listening, because we'll find you all. Are we ready to give a rating?
Yes. All right, you go first.
Okay, so this is a 10 out of 10 for me. I adore this film. Wow. It means everything to me. I just think it's a ton of fun. So I'm going to do a 10 out of 10 Dumbledores.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and you got to use obviously the first one, not the new guy.
That would be wild if I went in and I was like, different Dumbledore.
I would be pissed. I would be like, how dare you?
It's like not even the same scale. I liked parts of this movie a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I actively disliked other parts of the movie, and it was so very long, the parts that I didn't like.
For sure.
So I feel like if it had been a little bit shorter and a little bit more like cut to the other pieces, which like I know I've seen how long the tome that you brought to Arizona was. So mm-hmm. I understand this is a long book and they probably already cut a lot, but I felt like there was moments that dragged really hard for me. So I'm giving it a 7 out of 10. Henry Cavill's.
Oh, very nice.
And I'm going with grown-up Henry Cavill.
Awesome.
Because finding young Henry Cavill attractive is a little spooky for me.
Obviously, it's your choice. You get to pick whatever Henry Cavill you like. But my favorite is the one, a freeze frame of him literally cocking his arms before he punches that guy in Mission Impossible.
I'll go see if I can get Henry Cavill loading his guns.
Amazing. So thank you everyone who voted on this wonderful movie. You gave me an excuse to gush about one of my favorite properties for an hour and 13 minutes. It'll be shorter than that on the recording because we have
because I left for a little water break.
But that's the ultimate birthday present to me. So thank you, everybody. And can't wait to go back to Jane Eyre. I feel so refreshed now.
Speaking of birthdays, it feels weird that we're not talking about Jane Eyre. We're recording this on April 21st, which is Charlotte Bronte's birthday.
Hey.
Happy birthday, Charlotte.
Happy birthday, ghost.
207. You look great.
Yeah. You wrote something that gave us the reason to have this podcast. So,
yeah,
thanks.
And meet all of our lovely listeners, you guys.
Yeah. So if you want to tell us your thoughts about revenge or sword fights or why hot air balloon entrances need to be more common in today's economy.
Or send affordable hot air balloon rental suggestions in the state of Minnesota to Piper that she could maybe use for her wedding.
Yeah.
All of that can be done. How, Piper?
If you reach out to us on social, follow us there. We are at AirBuds. You can also send us emails, which we've received some wonderful correspondence recently. Always great to talk with you all. We are airbuds@gmail.com.
And if you want to even more than talk to us, but you also want to give us your money. Oh my God, guys, that's so nice.
Oh.
You can join Katie, our Jane, along with our other patrons on our Patreon. $3 and your vote counts even more in our Patreon polls. 5 times as much as a regular unpaid vote. and there's also cool quizzes and pretty pictures and all of that good stuff that you can get at multiple different levels. Don't forget, One More Jane and Piper will do fully a wrap for us, which I'm very excited about, and one day will happen. And she said one time she'd do it, so I'm never going to let it go.
True, true.
Did we remember to say what we're doing next week?
Not yet. So next week, we actually have a few kind of versions of this, but we're having a Jane Eyre fan fiction episode.
Pew, pew, pew.
So this one, we are going to be choosing a few pre-written Jane Eyre fanfics. And I believe it was Paula who put that beautiful document together for us.
She was also the, we'll call her producer of our ballet episode, because she sent us a wonderfully similar document for our ballet episode.
So Paola gave us a bunch of wonderful recommendations, which I will be browsing to select some options from. I'll also probably just do a quick little hop online, see if anything catches my eye. So who knows? Maybe if you listen to the show and you also write fanfic, maybe you'll tune in and we'll be talking about your story. Who knows? So we're gonna
This feels like something that could end up with a second part. So if you are like, no, but my favorite Jane Eyre fanfic is 100,000 words and I need you to read it by next Friday. we're probably not going to be able to make that happen, but send it over to us anyway and we'll see what we can do.
Yes, exactly. So we'll be doing that. But yeah, if you liked what you heard today, please give us a 5-star rating on your podcast thing of choice. Thing of choice. And tell us which Guy Pearce movie you want to watch over and over again.
Or if you think that maybe Guy Pearce has bad vibes and not that he's a good actor,
then tell us which Henry Cavill movie you want to watch 1,000 times.
Is it Cavill? I thought it was Cavill.
I think it's Cavill, but I sometimes say Cavill, and I think it's because I'm thinking of Cruella. But
okay,
you know,
which similar vibes.
This has been Air Buds, ladies and gentlemen. Happy Jane Eyre reading and watching. Thank you for joining us. Bye.
Bye.